The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are immersing ourselves in, well, a really foundational text, Plato's Apology. It's high-stakes stuff, a real-time drama that I think sets the benchmark for intellectual integrity. It's all centered on one man's final, unforgettable defense of his life.
And yeah, right off the bat, we should probably clarify that title for you listening. When we say apology, it's not Socrates saying, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Right.
The Greek word apologia, it means a defense, a formal justification, really. So this text is Socrates' brilliant and frankly defiant final speech.
Okay, so we're looking at the trial of Socrates in Athens back in 399 BCE. The formal charges against him were corrupting the city's youth and impiety, basically, not respecting the state gods. So our mission here is to get beyond just the historical facts and really try to understand the core lesson. Why did this incredibly brilliant older man choose death over, say, just keeping quiet or compromising his philosophical way of life?
It really boils down to that ultimate choice, doesn't it? Comfort versus conscience.
Yeah.
And his choice, well, it fundamentally shaped Western philosophy as we know it.
So to really get the speech, we need to talk about the writer first, Plato. Who was he? Who was this person chronicling such a massive turning point?
Right. Plato, born around 428 BCE, was Socrates' really devoted student. You could almost say his philosophical successor. He came from a pretty well-off Athenian family, aristocratic background.
Ah, okay. So he was part of the establishment in a way.
Exactly. Which puts him right in those political and social circles that, you know, eventually condemned his own mentor. And that insider perspective gives his account this unique, kind of tragic weight, I think.
And crucially, Plato was most likely there, an eyewitness at the trial itself.
Yeah, that's the general consensus.
So his whole intellectual life afterwards, founding the Academy, which was basically the first university in the West, it seems like it was all built in a way as a monument to Socrates, to clear his name, to vindicate his legacy.
Absolutely. It was like a refusal to let the state's injustice just be the final word. The execution wasn't just the end of a life. It was the launch pad for an entire philosophical movement.
Huh.
Plato really dedicated himself to keeping the Socratic method alive, extending it. So the apology isn't just history. It's like the founding philosophical manifesto against silencing critical thought.
And it's structured kind of brilliantly, like a legal drama. You get Socrates' three distinct speeches delivered right there in front of this massive Athenian jury, 501 people, apparently.
Yeah, a huge jury. And the central argument running through the whole thing is simple, but pretty explosive for the time. Seeking truth, having moral integrity, being intellectually honest. These things have to come before worrying about your safety or popularity or even, you know, staying alive.
So he's really elevating philosophy here. It's not just something you do, like a hobby. It becomes a moral requirement.
Precisely.
And that leads to maybe his most famous line, the one that sort of defines what it means to be human for him. The unexamined life is not worth living.
That's a pretty terrifying standard, isn't it? What? Suggesting just passively existing isn't enough?
It really is. It throws down a gauntlet.
Mm.
So let's dig into those speeches, starting with the main defense, the first speech. Socrates does something interesting right away. He kind of sidesteps the specific charges from his current accusers, guys named Meletus and Annas.
Okay.
And instead, he focuses on what he calls the earlier accusers.
The earlier accusers. What does he mean by that? Like old grudges?
Sort of. It represents years and years of, well, slander, rumors and public smear campaigns that had been going on long before this trial, people painting him as a sophist, you know, someone who charged money for tricky arguments.
Ah, okay. Which he denied doing. Right. Or painting him as this dangerous intellectual studying things below the earth and in the sky, which was basically ancient Greek code for being an atheist or denying the traditional gods. They'd really poisoned public opinion against him for years.
So he has to tackle that first. How does he do it?
Well, he tells this story about the origin of his mission. It involves his friend Chaerephon going to the oracle at Delphi, you know, the ultimate source of truth back then.
Right, the oracle. Very famous.
And Chaerephon asks the oracle if anyone is wiser than Socrates. The oracle says no, no one is wiser. Socrates claims he was genuinely baffled by this. He thought of himself as profoundly ignorant, so how could the oracle possibly call him the wisest?
Okay, that does sound a bit convenient, maybe. Like the oracle said, I'm the best.
It does sound a bit like that.
Yeah.
But he frames it as a puzzle he had to solve. So he starts what he calls his divine mission, trying to prove the oracle wrong, actually.
Ow.
By going around and questioning all the people who had a reputation for being wise, the politicians, the poets, the craftsmen.
Wait, hold on. Isn't that a bit of a philosophical pretzel? He says he knows nothing, but then he goes on this very public campaign to show everyone else they know even less. Wasn't he just, like, setting himself up for conflict, maybe even being deliberately annoying?
Yes, that's exactly the critical tension here. And his big discovery, the aha moment, was this. He found that these supposedly wise men did know things, but only in their specific little areas. A politician knew politics. A poet knew poetry.
Okay, specialized knowledge. Makes sense.
But, and this is the key, they all made the fatal mistake of thinking that their expertise in one thing meant they were wise about everything, especially the big questions like morality, justice, how to live. They suffered from thinking they knew it all.
I see. So they had confident ignorance about the big stuff.
Precisely. And Socrates realized his wisdom, the thing that made him different, was actually his intellectual humility, recognizing the limits of his own knowledge. That's where that other famous line comes from. I know that I know nothing.
So he was wiser just because he knew he didn't know, while the others wrongly thought they did.
That's the core of it. And this realization, for him, defined his role in Athens.
Mm-hmm.
He uses this powerful analogy, the gadfly analogy.
The gadfly, like a horsefly.
Exactly. He describes Athens as this large and well-bred horse, but one that's become sluggish and complacent.
Okay.
And he, Socrates, is the divinely appointed gadfly, a little irritating insect whose job it is to constantly sting the horse-sting Athens, to wake it up, to push it towards self-reflection, towards virtue. His constant questioning wasn't just being difficult. He saw it as a necessary public service.
Like an act of civic duty, almost. A really annoying form of patriotism.
You could put it that way. A disruptive way of saying, hey, you're asleep at the wheel, challenge your assumptions. But as history tends to show, people rarely thank the person pointing out their complacency.
Clearly not in this case. After that first speech, the jury votes guilty, though apparently by a pretty slim margin, something like 280 to 221.
Yeah, relatively close. Which brings us to the second speech, the penalty phase. And this is where Socrates' defiance just goes, well, it goes through the roof.
Okay, what happens? The prosecution wants the death penalty, right?
They do. And Socrates is then asked, as was customary, to propose a counter penalty.
Yeah.
You know, suggest something like exile or a fine.
Standard procedure. Offer a lesser punishment.
Right. But instead of bargaining, instead of showing any remorse or asking for mercy, Socrates suggests he deserves a reward.
Wait, a reward? Seriously?
Seriously. He basically argues that his service to Athens, forcing people to think about wisdom and truth, is so valuable, it's comparable to what an Olympic hero does for the city's glory.
Wow.
So he proposes that he should get free meals for life in the Prytaneum.
The Prytaneum, wasn't that like the VIP lounge where they honored heroes and dignitaries?
Exactly, reserved for the highest honors,
yeah.
Olympic victors, important priests. So Socrates is basically telling this jury of 501 citizens, instead of trying to kill me, you should be honoring me, paying for my food for the rest of my life because I'm saving your souls.
That is incredibly bold, almost calculated to offend them.
It was absolutely a calculated move, the ultimate insult to their values, their authority. And his refusal to compromise is just total. He rejects the idea of exile, arguing, pretty logically, that if his own people in Athens can't stand his questioning, why would anyone else in some other city put up with him?
Good point. He'd just annoy people elsewhere.
Right. And then he famously declares that being forced into silence to stop doing philosophy would be unbearable, a kind of spiritual death sentence, worse than actual death. And that's when he delivers that absolute core statement again. The unexamined life is not worth living.
So basically, I'd rather die than shut up.
Pretty much. And that attitude, that sheer refusal to bow down or show fear, that's what seals his fate. The jury votes again on the penalty.
And this time?
This time, the margin for the death sentence is much, much wider. Overwhelming, really.
Okay. So that leads us to the third and final speech. His remarks after the death sentence is passed. He doesn't break down or plead?
Not at all. No begging, no complaining. Instead, he focuses entirely on philosophy, on righteousness. He actually makes a prophecy.
A prophecy?
Yeah, he tells his accusers and the jury that by killing him, they're harming Athens much more than they're harming him. The city is losing its essential critic, its moral gadfly. And he emphasizes this point. The difficulty is not to avoid death, but to avoid unrighteousness, for that runs faster than death.
Yep.
Meaning, escaping injustice is harder and more important than escaping physical death.
He's still teaching, even then. And what about death itself? Is he afraid?
He confronts it with incredible calm, using rational analysis. He basically says, look, death is one of two things. Neither is scary. Option one, it's like a deep, dreamless sleep, a complete annihilation of consciousness. And if that's the case, he calls it an unspeakable game, a profound rest.
Okay, that's one way to look at it. Peace and quiet, finally.
Right. Option two, death is a migration, a journey to another place. And if that's true, well, great. He can go hang out and continue his philosophical debates with all the greatest figures from the past. Homer, Hesiod, other heroes and thinkers.
Huh. So even in the afterlife, he just wants to keep asking questions.
Exactly. And nobody could execute him for it there.
Yeah.
It's this remarkably serene, logical, almost detached way of facing his own end.
It really is. Okay, let's try to pull out some of the biggest themes bubbling up here. First, that idea of self-knowledge being primary.
Yeah, absolutely. True wisdom, for Socrates, starts with that intellectual humility, recognizing the limits of what you know. That I know that I know nothing idea is, I think, incredibly relevant today.
How so?
Well, it's an antidote to dogmatism, isn't it? In our really complex, polarized world, admitting ignorance is the first step to actually learning something. If you assume you already have all the answers, you can't learn.
Good point. Okay, theme two, philosophy as a moral imperative.
Right. It's not just a theoretical game for academics in an ivory tower. Socrates makes it an essential obligation for everyone. We have to think critically about our values, our beliefs, why we live the way we do.
Even if it's uncomfortable or makes us unpopular.
Especially if it's uncomfortable or makes us unpopular. That's the whole point. We have to do it regardless of social pressure to just conform.
And the third big theme seems to be that clash, the individual conscience versus the power of the state.
Definitely. When Socrates declares, I shall obey God rather than you, you being the Athenian court, that's huge. It lays down the philosophical blueprint for civil disobedience, basically.
Saying there are times when your personal moral conviction has to take precedence over unjust laws or demands from the state.
Precisely. It's a really foundational idea for challenging authority nonviolently.
You know, the power of the apology is also just in how memorable some of these lines are. They really stick with you.
They absolutely do. They're aphoristic almost, that core challenge. The unexamined life is not worth living. It just hangs there demanding a response from anyone who hears it.
Yeah. And then there's that critique of just chasing money and status, which feels so modern.
Right.
Are you not ashamed of heaping up the greatest amount of money and honor and caring so little about wisdom and truth? Oof. It's close to home, maybe.
Huh. It can, can't it? Still feels relevant after, what, 2,400 years? And finally, there's that statement of ultimate conviction, almost a comfort. No evil can happen to a good man, either in life or after death.
What does he mean by evil there, exactly? Clearly, bad things did happen to him. He was executed.
Right. By evil, he means true harm. Harm to the soul, harm to one's virtue.
Okay.
External things, poverty, sickness, even death, can't touch your inner moral state, your goodness, unless you let them. So, for Socrates, virtue is the ultimate shield. Nothing can truly harm a good person's core being.
Okay, that makes sense. So if we try to translate this into, like, real-life applications today, that gadfly role seems really relevant in professional settings.
Oh, massively. Think about it in organizations. Leaders who embrace that Socratic questioning constructively, they're playing the gadfly role. They challenge assumptions. They push back against groupthink.
Even if it makes meetings uncomfortable sometimes.
Especially then. It requires being willing to ask those awkward questions like, wait, what fundamental assumptions are we making about our customers here? Could they be totally wrong?
Mm.
It prevents stagnation and potentially disaster.
And on a personal level, how can we apply this?
Well, the most direct application is systematic self-reflection. Actually taking the time to stop and ask yourself, do my daily actions, my career choices, how I spend my time and money, do these things actually line up with the values I say I hold?
Or am I just running on autopilot, following unconscious habits?
Exactly. It's about making your life examined, not unexamined. And it also totally changes how you communicate.
How so?
If you adopt a Socratic approach in conversations, especially disagreements, your goal shifts. You're not trying to win the argument anymore. You're genuinely trying to understand the other person's perspective, asking, why do you believe that?
Yeah.
Instead of just stating why they're wrong.
Yeah, that would definitely reduce defensiveness. Foster actual learning, maybe.
It really can.
Yeah.
Seeking understanding over victory.
You know, thinking back on the whole thing, what stands out most for me is just his calm. It's almost eerie. Facing death, he doesn't panic. He rationalizes it, dissects it, strips it of its power to frighten.
Mm.
He forces everyone, his accusers then, and us reading it now, to focus not on the end of life, but on the quality of the life lived. It feels like the ultimate intellectual victory, even as he's condemned.
That's a great way to put it. And maybe that leads us to the final thought, the question the apology kind of leaves hanging in the air for us today. Socrates was essentially killed for being annoying, right? For being the necessary critic, the gadfly.
Yeah, pretty much.
So the question is, does our modern society truly value the gadfly? Or do we just find new ways, maybe through social media pressure, cancel culture, intense polarization? Do we find new ways to effectively execute the critical thinkers, the dissenters, the people who irritate us, but might actually be telling us something important we need to hear?
That's something to chew on. Do we still silence the gadflies just differently?
It's worth asking. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.